tonight, which is variegated and multifaceted. But primarily what we're going to be looking at is the connection between some important incidents, most notably Watergate, with some of the kinds of things that are going on still today, some of the things that are cropping up in the news. And of course, in a larger sense, this is basically what the entire series of broadcasts that we've done here at KFJC has been about, which is to take some things that seem to be events separated from the present by not only years but by importance, and put them into the context where you can understand how directly our lives are affected today by many of the things that have happened in the past. Now, of course, a lot of what we've talked about is things having to do with the great political reorganization that took place during and after World War II. But of course, we've had some great political reorganizations more recently, and one of them, at least a reorganization of a sort, although to look at the folks back in power these days, one would guess that it was not a very long-term reorganization. But one of those was, in fact, Watergate. And as we talked about during the Guns of November tapes, when we were discussing the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, tracing back from Watergate to the Kennedy assassination were a number of rather intriguing threads. And what we're going to do tonight is trace both directions from Watergate, among other things, both forwards and backwards, and find some intersections or some networking between the folks involved in Watergate and some of the other events that took place beforehand, and also some of the events that are taking place now.
We're also going to take a look at some events which are reminiscent of Watergate. So I guess by way of thematically conceptualizing the show, you could call the program Echoes of Watergate. Some of the same people, some of the same kinds of tactics, and some events which intersect with Watergate one way or another.
That's right. And as is so often the case with the show, if things seem mysterious, be patient, and we will do our best to draw this all together, this vast murk of tangle and webs and tracery. And if it's still complicated and you're still not quite sure, we will be opening the phones later on, and please feel free to call us up, and we'll try and straighten it out. The first article we're going to read is from the New York Times for Thursday. I almost said for New York, obviously. For Thursday, September 26th, 1985. The headline is U.S. AIDS, A-I-D-E-S, find gun smuggling is a low priority. It says the following article is based on reporting by Joel Brinkley and Jeff Girth and was written by Mr. Brinkley. It's a special to the New York Times, Dateline Washington, September 25th. United States law enforcement officials say they are having little success stopping illegal exports of American-made arms. Most of the agencies say halting gun smuggling is not a high priority, even though they acknowledge that domestically manufactured weapons are increasingly being smuggled abroad, particularly to Latin America, where they have been used in attacks against Americans and leaders of governments friendly to the United States. Federal officials say they are concerned about the smuggling, but, at the same time, numerous government officials and others involved in the arms business say that United States policies often foster illegal gun running. Since the government itself sometimes makes covert arms purchases for intelligence operations abroad, some major arms traffickers get government protection, these sources say, even though those same traffickers may at other times sell arms to enemies of the United States. Skipping down. When federal officials do make an effort to catch gun runners, loopholes in federal laws often let the smugglers go free and, quote, the guns end up going into a black hole, unquote, said Edward D. Conroy, special agent in charge of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Office in Miami. Federal officials describe southern Florida as the nation's largest market for illegal arms smuggling. Even when federal law enforcement officers do file charges against an illegal arms trafficker, sometimes they are forced to halt their case after learning that the suspect is receiving protection from the Central Intelligence Agency or another federal agency that sometimes acquires weapons through unofficial channels. Quote, that may be a dangerous statement, but yes, that happens, unquote, said Leon W. Gwynn, acting special agent in charge of the Miami office of the Customs Service. Quote, when I investigate an illegal arms sale, he added, we find out the traffickers are working both sides of the street. They are working with the CIA or the Department of Defense or somebody else, and then I get a call from Washington and they might leave me just a small part of the case, unquote. Judy S. Hoyer, H-O-Y-E-R, a Florida state prosecutor who was an assistant United States attorney in Tampa until earlier this year, said, quote, the government has ways of making cases disappear. A spokesman for the CIA said the agency would not comment on whether it maintained relationships with arms dealers. One international arms dealer based on the East Coast, who federal law enforcement officials describe as a frequent and reliable informer on illegal arms trafficking, said in an interview, quote, "The government makes it possible for us. Selling arms isn't really frowned on by the government." Skipping down, the East Coast arms dealer, who is also a broker, said there were five or six major international arms dealers in the United States who at times might have been involved in transactions of questionable legality, in addition to dozens of smaller dealers involved in possibly illegal sales. That means the five or six major dealers may at times market arms that are not supposed to be available for commercial sale, or they may sell arms to groups or nations that are not supposed to get American weapons, like Iran, nations of the Soviet bloc, or the Irish Republican Army. A federal law enforcement official said the estimate appeared to be accurate, although the government did not know for sure. The East Coast arms dealer said, quote, "The ones that are smart and are making it work with the government. All of them work with the CIA, the FBI, the Defense Intelligence Agency, or somebody else. I've always cooperated with the government," the dealer said, adding that the relationship consisted of, quote, "a give and a take. As long as they know what's going on, they don't stop you." Mrs. Hoyer, the former assistant United States attorney, said, quote, "We'd open arms trafficking cases, and then the agents would call back later and say the case no longer existed. The file has been removed, and we'd get word later that the intelligence people were permitting the arms deals to go on or were conducting it themselves." As a result, Mrs. Hoyer said, some arms traffickers have, quote, "one foot on each side of the fence." A Miami man, who federal officials describe as the largest arms dealer in the United States and perhaps in the world, got unusual treatment in a 1982 criminal case in which his attorney submitted a sealed court statement describing his client's, quote, "great assistance to the United States," the court record says. A federal grand jury indicted the arms dealer, Sarkis G. Soganalian, spelled S-O-G-H-A-N-A-L-I-A-N. That's the last name, Soganalian or Soganalian. A Lebanese citizen who lives in Miami, on three counts of fraud, this is the indictment, in 1981, in connection with the sale of 197 50-caliber machine guns to Mauritania. If convicted, he could have been sentenced to 15 years in prison or deported, but Mr. Soganalian was allowed to plead guilty to one count, while at the same time telling the court he was not really guilty of the charge. Stephen Gilman, who was an assistant United States attorney involved in the case, said the plea arrangement was, quote, "not the normal practice in his office," but he declined further comment. Federal District Judge Joe Eaton, who accepted the arrangement, said that the case was unusual because it involved, quote, "international affairs conducted by the State Department." In addition, Judge Eaton said that, quote, "it is recognized by the government that this man is in some part of international business, a legitimate one," and that Mr. Soganalian should be able, quote, "to carry on his business," unquote, and continue traveling abroad as required. Mr. Soganalian was sentenced to 5 years probation, and the government agreed not to deport him. Gerald F. Richman, one of Mr. Soganalian's attorneys, said he assumed his client's relationship with the government affected the terms of his sentence. That's a really tough assumption to make. Quote, "there is not any question Sarkis has been of assistance to the United States," Mr. Richman said, adding that his client's contacts included the CIA and the State Department. Quote, "but in more detail, I cannot go." Well, in more detail, of course, we can go and have gone, and this is the kind of stuff we talk about quite a bit. It's interesting for a variety of reasons, though. One of them is that now there appears to be a form of limited hangout going on here, in the fact that there is now a sort of a tacit admission by certain low-level members of the government that, yes, in fact, sometimes these arms dealers take advantage of their relationship with us to ship arms to people we don't want them to ship them to. Well, this doesn't answer several questions that come to mind. One is it possible that, in fact, these people are shipping arms to people that the government does want them to ship them to, but that the government just does not want to be connected to it? Of course, we've known for a long time that the government manipulates sales by other countries, such as Israel, to places such as South Africa and Guatemala, which the United States Congress has forbidden the executive branch from having dealings with, especially of the kind that wind up with transfers of automatic weaponry. But the United States has often pressured countries like Israel to make those sales on their behalf. Now, we also know, because of our study of people like Ed Wilson and Frank Turple, that there are a lot of people with connections directly into the government who claim to be ex-CIA agents, but seem to still have a lot of clout within the agency and within other agencies of the government who are involved with all kinds of arms deals to very hot clients in the Middle East, in South and Central America, all over the world, and in many cases doing the kinds of things that lead people like Dave and myself to believe that a lot of this, say, of these quote-unquote illegal and unstoppable sales of weapons by government-contacted, government-connected contractors is, in fact, with the direct permission and, in fact, perhaps the urging of the government itself. So that's one of the things that we've been looking at and that we will continue to look at.
In fact, a few weeks ago we looked at some review, really, some material from Le Matin about Stibon, the arms for drugs ring that's front and center in the investigation of the shooting of the Pope. And specifically, we looked at some statements by Glauco Partel, U.S. intelligence agent involved with that ring, where he said basically this whole operation is an extension of the State Department and intelligence services. Also looked at dealings with some of the countries that the United States would not want the public to realize they're dealing with, Poland and so forth, and I see you waving there, Nip.
Oh, well, I was going to say, now, for those of you, again, who are either easily confused, well, you wouldn't have to be that easily confused, or who are new listeners to the show, the Stibon Guns and Drugs Ring and Glauco Partel, that Dave referred to, just to name two things that we have fairly conclusively been able to link them to. One of them was the attempted assassination of the Pope, and the other was the sale of at least two atomic weapons to Syria, in which an old actor friend of Ronald Reagan's was apparently involved, or at least has been indicted for same, Rosano Brazzi. So when we're talking now, then the paper, the New York Times in their article, while it's an alarming thing to think about these kinds of people getting government protection, when you're thinking about, oh, so they're selling, you know, 197 automatic weapons to Mauritania, you know, what a shame. Well, no, in fact, what we're talking about is these people involved with things like shooting the Pope and shipping atomic bombs to Syria, which is of a slightly different order of magnitude, but the government, even the low-level functionaries, do not appear ready to talk too much about that yet.
Recall that one of the things that's figured prominently in all of our discussion here, and that May's talked about for many years, is the whole idea of provocation. Setting something up, blaming it on your enemy, and using that as an excuse to do something that you really want to do to begin with. And in the case of arming America's enemies, of course, that serves not only to justify larger military expenditures and a more aggressive and militaristic foreign policy, but also that the whole argument about the war against terrorism has figured very prominently at home, and with the authorities urging us to be willing to accept drastic restrictions on our civil liberties so that we can combat the terrorist menace. Now, if you want to do something like that to begin with, arming countries which are America's enemies or are said to be America's enemies is one way of justifying that. And Stibon, of course, we've looked at not only in connection with shooting the Pope and arming Syria with nuclear bombs, but also with getting automatic rifles for the Contras. And so it's a very tangled Mediterranean merry-go-round, as we refer to it. But think about the justifications for, the utility, really, of the whole terrorist menace in terms of aggressive foreign policy, restricted civil liberties at home, and consider the whole arms traffic and arming of enemies and so forth in connection with that. And of course, anytime you're talking about the arms traffic, we're talking about arms for drugs, and we'll be getting into that in months to come.
That's right. And before Dave reads the next article, lest you should think that there's no connection here between Watergate and the various things we've just talked about, Dave will be bringing up some specific Watergate connections in the next article. But for those of you who are not familiar with this situation, I would recommend strongly to you that you go out and track down a book called The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Kruger, which talks specifically about the Nixon administration's various clandestine dealings in drugs and weapons, most of them routed through South Florida, as a matter of fact, through Miami, and most of them conducted by CIA and DEA agents. And we don't possibly have the time to review that all now, but if you do not read that book, you are missing a real treat, because it is a fantastic, fantastically informative book, as well as being a very vital book to understand some of the things that have gone on in this country in the last few years.
In fact, most of the people who were gathered together for the Watergate operation had backgrounds in narcotics enforcement, G. Gordon Liddy among them. So there's a very direct connection there. And as Nip said, the Great Heroin Coup is a great place to read about it. You won't know the meaning of the phrase Miami Vice until you have read that book. Believe me, it's quite a book. And it really does set the whole South Florida gun running and drug smuggling tangle in a much more lucid and, I think, sinister light. It tends to be passed off as sort of a high-tech version of the California Gold Rush, and there's something, you know, albeit slightly illicit, but winked at, you know, and an aura of big bucks and lots of Cadillacs and so forth, which certainly there is, but it's a very sinister and explicitly fascistic milieu.
It's not big bucks we have to worry about. It's Big Brother.
Indeed. Now, connections between that South Florida intelligence and fascist milieu, intelligence-related and fascist-inspired milieu, we're going to tie that in right now in a very direct way with a story which we read, not only read a couple of years ago, but which has cropped up in the news this past week. Now, South Africa in general has been one of the major focuses of the news during recent months. Specifically this past week, there's been a lot of copy devoted to the recent South African incursion into Angola. South Africa has been very much involved with military ventures against its neighbors in one capacity or another for a long time. And specifically, they just sent a bunch of commandos into Angola, where they say they were preventing attacks by SWAPO, which is attempting to get the former South African protectorate of Namibia, now supposed to be an independent country, but the South Africans are hanging on to that. We're going to talk about that in a second. Basically, SWAPO is fighting for an independent and independent Namibia. South Africa is still hanging on to that territory. South Africa justifies its actions in Angola as being necessary, not only to stabilize the situation there, but to counterbalance the Cuban presence in Angola. Well, the United States, and specifically CIA, has been very active along with South Africa against the Angolan government there. We've looked in the past at the involvement of the Blakeys, and who figure prominently with Jonestown and all of the intelligence connections at Jonestown. Specifically, we're going to take a look at cooperation between CIA and BOSS, the South African Secret Service, in the attempted destabilization of Angola. The information which I'm about to read you comes from an article which appeared in Covert Action Information Bulletins, issue number 18 from the winter of 1983. And specifically, this article is called Statement to the UN, the CIA, and BOSS. Now, this is authored by Bill Schaap, S-C-H-A-A-P. He is one of Covert Action Information Bulletin's co-editors, and this is the transcript of a short speech that he gave to the Special Political Committee of the UN General Assembly on November 8th of 1982. Okay, and again, this is reprinted in CAIB's issue of November of the winter of 1983, number 18. It's called the CIA and BOSS, and once again, BOSS is the name of the South African Secret Service. I say that because the New York City Anti-Organized Crime and Red Squad is also called BOSS, and we've talked about that in the past in connection with the assassination of Malcolm X and also in connection with Watergate. Bill Schaap, by the way, the information is lavishly footnoted here. This article is about a little over 2.5 pages, and there are a total of 32 footnotes, so the information that he presents here is copiously documented. I'm not going to stop and read the footnotes, or it would be unintelligible because I'd have to stop about every two sentences. But again, for about a 2.5-page article, there are a total of 32 footnotes. And if you'd like to read the article for yourself, again, CAIB, Covert Action Information Bulletin number 18, winter of 1983. Schaap writes, or actually spoke to a UN General Assembly, "To a large extent, Mr. Chairman, South Africa has maintained its illegal apartheid regime in Namibia by waging a vicious war against Angola as well as against the people of Namibia itself. The CIA has been of invaluable assistance on both fronts. The U.S. has said that it supports the independence of Namibia, just as it has said that it abhors apartheid. But here, too, actions speak louder than words. The U.S. has covertly hindered the complete and unqualified independence of Namibia for many years, particularly in its secret support for the Democratic Turnhall Alliance," that's T-U-R-N-H-A-L-L-E, "exposed in an October 1976 confidential UN memorandum. and the CIA has been entirely responsible for much of the fighting in Angola. In fact, it has been pointed out that, quote, there never was a civil war in Angola at all. The CIA paid the FNLA and the UNITA, UNITA, and armed them in order to mount a challenge to the MPLA. Interrupting, the MPLA is the dominant political party in Angola, and it, after a quote, civil war, in fact, a CIA and a South African-sponsored mercenary war, that party came to power and is in power today. Continuing here. And as former South African intelligence agent Gordon Winter put it, the FNLA was founded, funded, and run by the CIA. UNITA was founded by CIA and remains controlled by CIA. Jonas Savimbi's UNITA retained such links with the CIA despite the Clark Amendment, by which the U.S. Congress expressed its desire that there be no further clandestine interference in Angola. Again, interrupting, the Clark Amendment was just repealed a few weeks ago or months ago. As late as the spring of 1981, Savimbi met in Rabat, Morocco, with CIA officers, and his representatives are regularly reported having such meetings. Recently, a new and deadly element has been added. CIA-trained Cuban exiles are now planning to assist the South Africans on the Namibian and Angolan fronts. In February, the Miami Herald reported that Wilfredo Navarro boasted publicly that he and some 500 mercenaries advised by Watergate burglar Frank Sturgis were going to establish a base in Angola. In March, according to United Press International, Sturgis, who admits to being a longtime CIA agent, claimed he had traveled to Angola in connection with this plan. And in April, according to Expresso of Lisbon, Sturgis, on behalf of the CIA, was reported at Lisbon meetings with South African intelligence officers and Angolan exiles. Involvement with brutal killers like some of the Cuban exiles is nothing new or extraordinary for either the CIA or a boss. The Wilmington News Journal reported in 1980, quote, South Africa's Bureau of State Security began hiring CIA-trained anti-Castro fanatics in 1973 to carry out contract killings. Indeed, there is some suggestion that these CIA killers were responsible for the unsolved murders of Mr. and Mrs. Robert Smith, SMIT, in South Africa in 1977. It is still unclear to what degree the CIA and boss share the responsibility for the murder of Ruth First, F-I-R-S-T, in Mozambique this past August. So there are a couple of things to look at there. First of all, the joint U.S. and South African cooperation against the Angolan government should be weighed against the recent South African incursion and against the at least superficial U.S. condemnation of that action. Obviously, the U.S. has been very much involved with the very kinds of actions that they're now condemning the South Africans for quite some time. So how sincere the condemnation is should be carefully weighed. Beyond that, we took a look at the intersection between the Miami Vice milieu, so to speak, that we took a look at just a second ago, the South Florida weapons and intelligence, weapons smuggling and intelligence milieu, with U.S. CIA and boss efforts against Angola. Specifically, we took a look at reports in the Portuguese newspaper or weekly Expresso, talking about Sturgis working on behalf of CIA and UNITA and with South Africa against Angola. And in the footnote, a footnote, I should say, to that passage I just read you, it mentions the issue of Expresso as being August 7th of 1982. Now, remember the August 7th, 82 date here, because I'm going to read you an article from the Manchester Guardian's issue of August 17th, 1982. Research credit for this goes to Ted Rubenstein, an excellent researcher who's been working with us for some years now. And again, Ted got this from the Manchester Guardian of August 17th, 1982, 10 days after Expresso's issue of August 7th, 1982. And remember the accounts in Expresso about Sturgis, CIA, South Africa, and their efforts against Angola. From the Manchester Guardian of 8-17-82, a Jill Jolliffe, J-O-L-L-I-F-F-E story from Lisbon, headlined, Evidence of South Africa Plot Missing. A leading Portuguese weekly, Expresso, this week published an extensive set of documents to support allegations of a South African-backed plot to overthrow the Angolan government, then announced that the documents had been stolen from the printer's premises. The Portuguese government last week ordered an inquiry into Expresso's previous allegations that a South African embassy official and a security agent had been recruiting mercenaries in Lisbon for the plot codenamed Operation Kubango, K-U-B-A-N-G-O. Also involved in the plot, Expresso said, were senior members of the Angolan government and representatives of the Angolan dissident movements UNITA and FNLA. The Weekly referred to a senior South African intelligence officer, General J.J. Kemp, K-E-M-P, using the alias Jack Rollins, as having taken part in a planning meeting in London on April 15th with nine conspirators named as Pedro Francisco and Paul Tuba of the FNLA, Antonio da Costa Fernandes of UNITA, and a former Watergate burglar Frank Sturgis, now an anti-Castro activist, Gary Van Dyke, described as a colonel in the South African Defense Force, Victor Fernandez, a former MPLA police official, and three members of the Angolan administration whom it did not name. A document said to have been signed by the men pledged support for Operation Kubango, which involved recruiting 2,000 mercenaries at a cost of $5 million, or 2.94 million pounds, to attack Luanda in two columns from the north and south. Expresso said last week that South African forces would lead the southern strike from Namibia on the pretext of hitting SWAPO bases inside Angola, and that South Africa had agreed to provide the money. Expresso printed a letter signed Jack Rollins on Republic of South Africa letterhead and dated London, May 20th. It was addressed to Gary Van Dyke and promised, quote, all kinds of moral, political, and military support, unquote. It urged that members of the team should visit South Africa soon to take up details of, to tie up details of the plot. Funds for the plot were to be channeled through three companies, a South African government agency Front, a Portuguese firm, and the Paris branch of a UNITA-linked business which operated in Luanda before Angolan independence. Another document listed weapons and other material required for the operation, which were largely light arms and transport, a list consistent with the needs of a force of 2,000 mercenaries. The degree of direct military support to be afforded by South Africa was outlined only in the vague terms of the letter from Jack Rollins, unquote, and in the list of military requirements which the statement said will, statements of military requirements with the statement that, quote, aircraft and helicopters will be provided during the operation, unquote. Announcing the disappearance of the documents, Mr. Joaquim Vieira, V-I-E-I-R-A, a co-author of the articles, said that no special security members measures had been considered necessary. The robbery appeared to have been carried out by an employee. Quote, we believe somebody who knew the building returned and stole them and was probably paid to do so, unquote, he said. Well, interesting that after the aforementioned reference to the mention in the covert action information bulletin to the August 7th, 1982 issue of Expresso detailing CIA, South African, and anti-Castro Cuban efforts against the Angolan government. The anti-Castro Cubans, of course, working under CIA auspices, and specifically this group being organized by Frank Sturgis. Interesting that the, a Manchester Guardian account from 10 days later carries an article about the series of articles in the Expresso mentioning that the documents upon which they were based had been stolen. Of course, Frank Sturgis is a person whose name crops up in connection with political burglary, of course, being a convicted Watergate burglar. And it's worth noting, of course, that in our Guns of November show number 3, we talked about connections between Watergate and the assassination of President Kennedy, and specifically about Frank Sturgis, his work against Fidel Castro. And, of course, you can't separate the efforts against Castro from the Kennedy assassination, but specifically we talked about Sturgis's role in providing disinformation about possible Castro involvement in the assassination of President Kennedy. And these documents turn up missing from Expresso is certainly, we can't say who is responsible, but as I say, whenever Frank Sturgis's name seems to come up, we find very often it is in the context of political burglary. And of course, one of the things that we looked at also in connection with the Kennedy assassination concerned a company called Centro Mondiale Commerciale, or Permindex, which was a NATO funding conduit, basically a NATO intelligence front, which appears to have served as the funding conduit for much of the money used to finance the assassination of President Kennedy. And in addition to having a lot of interesting connections to plots against French President Charles de Gaulle, because elements of the French intelligence milieu who resented Charles de Gaulle's surrender, they felt, of the former French colony of Algeria. They conspired with elements of CIA and elements of NATO intelligence against the life of Charles de Gaulle. Permandex, or Centro Mondiale Commerciale, was involved with those plots. By the way, those plots also detailed very nicely in the book which Nip referred to, The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Kruger. That whole French intelligence war figures very prominently. Worth noting, though, that Centro Mondiale Commerciale, after having been exposed for its CIA activities, moved to Johannesburg, South Africa. So these sets of connections go around and around the world. And one of the things that we've tried to point out in connection with South Africa, which is a story which is getting a lot of coverage now, of course, and rightly so, is that the situation there is part of a much larger problem. And what we try to show on this broadcast within the context of South Africa is just how the South African political situation intersects with a much larger pattern of repression.
Interestingly enough, now we're going to go back to the subject of France and some similarities between some things going on in France to Watergate here in the United States. But I just noticed as I was looking at this page that in the middle of this page, which this article that we're going to get to is one of them, and we'll talk about that in a moment, and then an article down at the bottom about how apartheid and the apartheid laws, of which the United States has been a fairly willing partner for a long time, have been sending children to jail in South Africa, and other articles here about South Korean police, South Korea, of course, being a prime ally of the United States, beating up students. And then down in the bottom here, kind of stuck off to the side, is a little snippet of an article mentioning that George Shultz is going to receive a foreign policy award, the same award previously received by Henry Kissinger and Jean Kirkpatrick, for theory and practice of foreign policy, as the kids go to jail in South Africa and get beaten up in South Korea. Anyway, just an interesting sidelight as to the kinds of proximities and strange bedfellows you can find in your newspaper if you just look. This newspaper happens to be the New York Times for Saturday, September 28th, 1985. Now, as I hinted at briefly, this article is also about France, which, as Dave mentioned, figures strongly the French intelligence services, specifically the SDECE, figure strongly in the Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Kruger, and the ongoing relationship between certain disaffected members of the French intelligence service and various fascist groups, and also the connection of these same people to various elements of the CIA and the DEA under the Nixon administration, make up a large part of the Great Heroin Coup. Now, what's going on in France right now is quite interesting, and of course most of you out there are familiar with the sinking of the Greenpeace ship, the Rainbow Warrior, and the death of a photographer who was aboard that ship. The fact that a group of French government officials admitted that government people had been involved in this. There have been numerous shakeups in France at the moment. The Mitterrand government is sort of reeling, and it is very similar in a lot of ways to Watergate in the fact that it's an intelligence operation whose cover was blown apparently from within, just as McCord blew the James McCord blew the Watergate operation open when they were just about ready to bury the whole thing, and McCord wrote a letter to John Sirica. McCord, of course, a former CIA employee, basically begging him to keep the case open and telling him that it went all the way in and into the administration and basically kept the Watergate case open. And some people, including Bernard Fensterwald, the guy who wrote Coincidence and Conspiracy about JFK, have suggested that McCord himself might have been operating on orders from higher up. And I believe Fensterwald actually was McCord's attorney for a while.
Fensterwald was McCord's attorney. And a similar thing, there's a new book out by Jim Hogan, the author of Spooks, called Secret Agenda, and he hints much the same thing.
Indeed. So when we're reading this article about some of the allegations being made by French government officials, bear that in mind, that these suggestions of that even Watergate, as tangled as it was, that we only know the half of it.
A couple of other sabotaged intelligence operations, which people can check out from our archives programs, are specifically the Bay of Pigs and the U2 operations, both of which we cover on our Guns of November show number one, in connection with defeating attempts at rapprochement with elements of the Soviet bloc. But if this, again, sounds a little far out to some people, accounts by a veteran of many U.S. covert operations and an acknowledged expert on the U.S. intelligence system, Fletcher Prouty, of sabotage of the U-2 incident and the Bay of Pigs invasion are carried on our Guns of November program number one.
Indeed. Okay, so I'm going to read this article again from the New York Times for September 28th, headlined, New Paris Intelligence Chief Alleges Plot Against Agency, by Richard Bernstein. Special to the New York Times, Dateline Paris, September 27th. The new head of France's intelligence agency said tonight that he had discovered, quote, a malicious operation to destroy the agency. Quote, I must tell you, said the director, General René Ambeau, that to my deep stupefaction I have discovered, and I weigh my words carefully, a veritably malicious operation to destabilize our secret services. I would even say, to destroy our secret services. The government has admitted that the agents of the intelligence service acting on orders were responsible for sinking an anti-nuclear protest ship in New Zealand. The case has caused a political scandal here. General Ambeau's statement tonight, while accusing no specific people or groups of acting against the agency, seemed to represent a new twist to the affair. The case began when the Rainbow Warrior, a ship belonging to the environmentalist group Greenpeace, was sunk by a bomb in Auckland Harbor on July 10th. The ship was to have led a protest flotilla against French nuclear testing in the Pacific. Skipping down, General Ambeau, spelled I-M-B-O-T, by the way, speaking tonight on French television, said earlier information from the intelligence agency about the sinking had been, quote, lies. Quote, I have found people who had to be punished, he said. I have cut off the rotten branches. What I mean is that from now on, all information that anyone claims to have or to have received from the service is a lie, because I have sealed off the service. General Ambeau was named to head the intelligence agency on Wednesday after the previous director, Admiral Pierre Lacoste, was dismissed for refusing to answer questions from the defense ministry about the sinking. Meanwhile, five members of the French armed forces, including the deputy head of the intelligence agency's counter-espionage division, have been formally charged with divulging secret information about the affair. Speculation on the arrest of the men has centered on the possibility that they gave information to the press to embarrass the socialist government. But General Ambeau asked tonight if the five arrested men were responsible for the purported destabilization effort, said, quote, no, others had charge of rotten branches, and I made allusion to that. I have cut the rotten branches. While General Ambeau's declaration contained no details or precise charges, it was similar in tone to earlier references to, quote, malignancies, or unanswered questions in the affair. In a denial of involvement in the sinking, read to journalists the day before he resigned as defense minister, Monsieur Arnoux said, quote, there is a malignancy in this affair, in these dark areas. Striking a similarly dark note, Prime Minister Fabius, in a television statement on Wednesday night, spoke of the possibility that someone had, quote, sabotaged the sabotage, a reference to speculation that the operation against the Greenpeace ship had been revealed in advance by unknown agents. In his declaration tonight, General Ambeau refused to answer a question about the possible involvement of foreign agents in a plot to destabilize the intelligence service. His declaration seemed in part a kind of public order to the military. Quote, all those who have served with me, he said, those officers and non-commissioned officers who will hear me this evening, when I say I have sealed off the service, they know what I mean. General Ambeau said he would move forward in reorganizing the agency, quote, because it would be unthinkable for our country, which is one of the five great nuclear powers of the world, to be deprived of its secret services, which are absolutely essential if our country is to keep its place in the world, unquote. Okay, well, if you could weave your way through the tangle of the Greenpeace sheep and the French military officers, what basically is going on here is a variety of things, and one of the things that's most interesting, not only the similarity to Watergate and the allusions on the part of specifically General Ambeau and others in the French government that this operation, the sabotage, was sabotaged, But the fact that in and of itself it's in a highly sensitive area, namely that of nuclear warfare, nuclear testing, and New Zealand, of course, which refused to take nuclear ships from the United States, among other places, and allow them to dock in their harbor and cause the first big break in the ANZUS alliance, which is the Australia, New Zealand, and United States Defense Alliance in the South Pacific, caused the first breach in the ANZUS alliance, caused a great deal of trouble, caused a lot of heavy-handed threats to be handed out on the part of the Reagan administration to the New Zealand government of Prime Minister David Lange. It's interesting that whoever selected this operation chose to attack the Greenpeace ship while it was in the Auckland Harbor in New Zealand, a ship that was specifically going to be used to protest nuclear testing. It's also interesting that it should be, some people should be suggesting that there were attempts from within the government, within the United, within the military and intelligence groups to sabotage specifically the socialist government of France. So there's a few different things to think of here.
Recall also John Dean's statement that there was a cancer on the presidency during Watergate. Anyway, last week the question came up as to why basically the Kennedy assassination is being investigated in the Philippines, whereas when it happened here, it did not get investigated. Of course, we were talking about the assassination of former Philippine Senator Benigno Aquino, which in many ways is very similar to the scenario we saw in Dallas on November 22, 1963, albeit a somewhat cruder version of the same scenario. Well, one of the things that we talked about last week was the fact that Benigno Aquino worked for the CIA, and specifically we speculated that elements in this country, specifically CIA and State Department, may have been ushering his return to the Philippines in order to ease out Marcos before he burns the barn there, much as the Shah did in Iran.
And before Dave starts this rather longish article, let me just mention to those of you who may not be aware, you are listening to KFJC Los Altos Hills.
Indeed. So what I thought we'd do is review the material about Benigno Aquino and his relationship to the CIA. We read this a little over a year ago, specifically in September of 1984. Reading a short section of an article from Counterspy magazine, specifically from Counterspy's issue of December 83 through February of 1984, in other words, winter 83-84. It's an article headlined, Benigno Aquino and the CIA. It's authored by John Kelly, who is one of the co-editors of Counterspy. And the article reads, one aspect of Aquino's life which is not well known was the intersection of his political career with the CIA. This relationship extended back to 1954 when, as a 20-year-old journalist, Aquino, in his capacity as a special assistant to the CIA-sponsored President Ramon Magsaysay, M-A-G-S-A-Y-S-A-Y, negotiated the surrender of Luis Taruc, T-A-R-U-C, the supremo of the old People's Army and of the old Communist Party. Magsaysay was literally created as a man of the masses, unquote, by one of the CIA's most skilled operatives in Asia, the notorious Colonel Edward Lansdale. And I would add that he, too, is also covered in The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Kruger at great length. Lansdale's mission was to head off the rising insurgency of the People's Army, popularly known as HUKS, H-U-K-S, right after World War II. To accomplish this, he combined military counterinsurgency efforts with a public relations campaign to persuade the people that Magsaysay, a small-time politician whom Lansdale had snatched from provincial obscurity, was, quote, a man of the masses, unquote. Key in this public relations effort were young men handpicked by Magsaysay and Lansdale, both of whom had sensitive antennae for talent. Not only Aquino, but also a number of others who became prominent political figures in later years were introduced to politics as their special assistants, unquote. One of the best and brightest was Raoul Manglapus, M-A-N-G-L-A-P-U-S, I don't know how that's pronounced, who served as Magsaysay's Undersecretary of Foreign Affairs and went on to become a senator. Manglapus later founded the Movement for a Free Philippines, the MFP, an anti-Marcos, anti-communist exile group. One of the striking common characteristics of the most prominent of the Magsaysay boys, like Aquino, was their being graduates of the Jesuit-run Ateneo de Manila University, the training ground of the sons of the Philippine elite. In the early 1950s, the American Jesuits who ran the Ateneo were at the forefront of the ideological struggle against the progressive nationalist movement, making them natural allies of their secular compatriots in the CIA, like Lansdale. Aquino's involvement with the CIA did not end when the HUKS were defeated in 1954. After his success in the Philippines, Lansdale went on to Vietnam, bringing with him a well-trained corps of Filipino counterinsurgents who operated under a humanitarian front called Operation Brotherhood, unquote. In an interview with the Multinational Monitor in February of 1981, Aquino provided a glimpse of his role in the Indochina counterinsurgency effort in the mid and late 1950s. Quote, "I've worked with your CIA on many operations. You know, I was assistant to three presidents. And once upon a time, I headed our own equivalent of the CIA. We had joint operations in Indonesia. We had joint operations in Laos. We were in Cambodia," unquote. So Aquino, apparently, according to his own account, head of the Philippine Intelligence Service at one point, and certainly a protege and cooperator of Colonel Lansdale. And worth evaluating all of this against some of the cooperations with between the Falange Party of Francisco Franco and key Philippine people and Douglas MacArthur's staff, specifically Andres Soriano, Franco's representative in the Philippines, a member of MacArthur's staff, and his association with Willoughby is one of the factors to keep in mind in terms of the historical development of the things we're looking at here.